Peace be upon you. Going to start with two verses, actually three verses, but from two different spots in the Quran, starting from 10:22 and 23, and then 17:67 reads, "We seek refuge in God from Satan the rejected. He's the one who moves you across the land and sea. You get onto ships, and they sail smoothly in a nice breeze. Then while rejoicing therein, violent wind blows, and the waves surround them from every side. This is when they implore God, sincerely devoting their prayers to him alone. If you only save us this time, we will be eternally appreciative. But as soon as he saves them, they transgress on earth and oppose the truth. O people, your transgression is only to the detriment of your own souls. You remain preoccupied with this worldly life. Then to us is your ultimate return. Then we inform you of everything you had done." 17:67 says, "If you are afflicted in the middle of the sea, you forget your idols and sincerely implore him alone. But as soon as he saves you to the shore, you revert. Indeed, the human being is unappreciative." And it's awesome that, you know, this is a very classic case that at the time of turbulence, at the time, you know, when we feel absolute despair, we don't hesitate imploring God. But the catch is, most of the time we implore, we think we're going to be eternally appreciative. God saves us and gives us stability, and we forget and we revert. And it's interesting, you know, God gives the example of someone who's, you know, lost at sea. And they're in the midst of a storm, and there's waves, and, you know, at that time, any human being, you know, automatically becomes a believer. They start imploring God, they start asking God, and they make promises to God, and, you know, God answers them, but what's ironic is then they end up reverting. And what's also funny is that typically they'll pray, they'll say, "God, please save us, you know, send us somewhere to flat, solid land, send us, you know, to a nice green pasture, a meadow, somewhere of stability." And what's ironic is, you know, we think that these places are stable, and it's really a blessing from God that we don't realize that in actuality, this planet that we're on, it's far from being as stable as we think. Realistically, it's, you know, the best way to describe it is we're literally on a ship. The ship is called Planet Earth, and we're hurling through space. And in chapter 27, verse 88, it says, "When you look at the mountains, you think they're standing still, but they're moving like the clouds. Such is the manufacture of God, who perfected everything. He is fully cognizant of everything you do." And what I'm getting at is, you know, when we zoom out and we look at the Earth, you know, you take a mountain and you zoom out, what do you see? You know, you see the planet Earth, in essence, in space, but it's hurling at 66,000 miles per hour around the sun. And we don't even notice this. You know, we don't think twice that we're traveling at such immense speeds. You know, imagine sitting in first class and you think, wow, you know, like Singapore Airlines, they have beds and TV and this and that. And we think how luxurious. But the catch is the slightest bit of turbulence and you feel it, you know. And now us, we're on this planet hurling through space and we don't even notice. We don't even think twice that there's this massive fireball that's like, you know, relatively close to us, 93 million miles away, that's just like emitting this mass amount of energy towards our direction. And if it's as if that's not crazy enough, the sun itself, you know, isn't just sitting static in the galaxy. It's moving through the galaxy at an estimated 483,000 miles per hour. And the Earth and all the planets are chasing the sun as it's hurling through the galaxy. And you can go online and look at some of these simulations of what the actual orbit of the sun and the Earth look like while the sun is traveling. And then if that's not crazy enough, the galaxy itself is traveling at an unimaginable 1.3 million miles per hour. Now, how awesome is this that all this is taking place and we don't even notice, right? We think that we're sitting in bed or we're sitting in a car or we're walking on solid ground, that we think that, hey, this is security, this is stability, I have nothing to fear, you know, it's not like I'm stranded in the middle of the sea or flying in a plane and, you know, hitting some turbulence. And it's realistically, it's such a blessing from God that he does this for twofold. One is that we're not on this constant state of alert and panic. But then two, it's the fact that it shows who are those who are truly appreciative. Who are the ones who reflect on this, that this is God's design, right? That we could have been sitting on a planet and in essence just been at the mercy of all the chaos that's going on out there. But we don't even, we don't even notice it. We actually go out of our way to observe it, which is a blessing in itself. And what else is awesome is you think of the way that the fact that we can even observe our galaxy, let alone the rest of the universe. It just happens that we're positioned in such a place within the Milky Way galaxy that we can view 80% of the observable universe. So we have front row seats, you know. If we were positioned anywhere else, not only would it be unlikely that the Earth would have been around for this long with this, length of stability, but we might not be able to differentiate the stars that were within our galaxy from the ones that are external to our galaxy. To be able to tell that, hey, there's literally billions and billions of galaxies out there, each with hundreds of billions of stars. And the fact that, our atmosphere itself serves as, a shield. It burns up the debris that, basically doesn't get blocked out by the magnetic field of the Earth, all the UVs and the harmful radiation, the gamma rays. But for the ones the debris that actually gets through, most of that gets burned up in the atmosphere. And it just happens that the atmosphere is transparent, right? That it's not something that's opaque that we couldn't see through, but it's actually perfectly designed for observation. And what else is interesting is that the sun, the spectrum of light ranges from like 10 to the minus 15 to 10 to the basically a thousand basically 1 kilometer, 1,000 meters, and you got radio waves and then cosmic rays, and it just happens that this very narrow band of light that the sun radiates is the visible light spectrum. This is what our eyes determine between blue all the way to red before you hit infrared and ultraviolet on the other side. And not only is this the light that the sun predominantly emits, it also happens to be the light that our atmosphere allows through. It doesn't reflect it back, which is just awesome. It's like, we're sitting this, this amazing spaceship, planet Earth, and we have front row seats to to the rest of the universe. And then in addition, so for some of the larger debris that was destined to hit the Earth, we have these planetary guards around us. Very up close, we have the moon, which is about 230,000 miles away, which is about one-fourth the size of the Earth, protecting us, providing stability to the planet. Hopefully, we'll talk about that shortly. But then on the other side, you have the sun, which is 100 times bigger than the Earth. Guarding us, from all these this possible debris that could be coming towards the Earth. But then you also have Jupiter, one of these the gas giant. And we had an example in '94 with Shoemaker. It was a comet that was heading towards Earth. By God's leave, it got sucked into Jupiter's atmosphere, and Jupiter, in essence, basically took the force of the impact. And for Jupiter, it was a blip, but we had front row seats to observe the impact. And they estimated that the impact was 12,000 kilometers across and equivalent to 6 million megatons of TNT, or 600 nuclear bombs going off simultaneously. And, we don't have to, we didn't have to experience that. I mean, that would be life devastating if something like that happened to the Earth. And, getting back to the moon, what's just absolutely just amazing is the fact that because we have the moon causes a tilt on the Earth. So we have about it's a 22.5 or 23 degree tilt on the Earth. And it just happens like the moon is, for a satellite, it's relatively large compared to all the other planets. Like if you look at the proportion between the Earth and the moon, the moon is about one-fourth the size of the Earth. And it causes this tilt. And you think, okay, what's the big deal about, it's just this tilt. But the tilt actually gives us stability in weather because it gives us the four seasons. Pending on, because of this tilt, the Earth is going to rotate between which side is going to be closer and further away from the moon. And this affects the tides, the temperature, and gives us stability. You think about it, like the moon itself is in interstellar phase lock with the Earth. We always see one side of it. If the Earth was positioned in such a way, one side of the Earth would be too hot to for life, and the other side would be too cold, at least for intelligent life. And this structure, it's something that again we take for granted. The fact that we have a rainy season and a summer, it's great for vegetation, for harvest. And the other aspect is they estimate that each year the moon's orbit increases by about 1 inch. So you go back, if you were to go back a million years ago or 100 million years ago, which is realistically it's a blip of time in the life of the Earth. The moon's orbit would have been 100 million inches shorter, meaning that the moon would have been that much closer to the Earth. And if the moon, like the moon, one of the aspects is that it controls the high and low tide. Can you imagine what life would have been like, if the moon was that much closer? How high these tides are. A lot of the places on the planet that we live, that we habitate, we wouldn't be able to. The tides would be too high, they'd be too monstrous. And we just happen to live at a time of relative stability. And it's something, again, just to be thankful for. And looking at the proportions between the sun, the moon, the earth, it's unreal. So just let me try to explain. So the earth to the moon is about 230,000 miles away. The Earth to the Sun is about 93 million miles away. If you divide 93 million miles by 230,000 miles, you get about approximately 400 is the ratio between how far the Moon is versus how far the Sun is, right? So it's 400. The Sun is 400 times further away from the Earth than the Moon, and it just happens that the size of the Earth and the Moon and the Sun. So the Sun, or as the Sun, yeah, it's 400 times bigger than the moon, right? So it's 400 times further away and it's 400 times bigger than the moon. And these proportions just happen to work out perfectly for what's known as a solar eclipse. And that's when the moon basically perfectly blocks out the sun at a certain place, at a certain time for the Earth, observers here on Earth. And it blocks out everything of the sun except for the chromosphere. Now think of this, if the moon's orbit was closer or further away, we might not have such a perfect viewpoint of a solar eclipse. And as far as I know, there is not another planet in the entire solar system that experiences a perfect solar eclipse. This just happens to happen on the one planet in the solar system that has the intelligent life to appreciate it. So other than the fact that solar eclipse looks cool, right? That's great. Like, okay, this is pretty awesome. It serves as one of the greatest basically large scale experimental tools that we could possibly comprehend, because the moon and the sun being in such perfect proportions to one another, blocking out the sun, we were able to tell a couple things from a solar eclipse. One was in 1919, they confirmed Einstein's theory of general relativity because they were able to conduct this massive scale experiment just because of how lucky we are with these proportions. The other thing was that they were able to confirm the makeup of stars, right? Being our sun, that it was predominantly made from hydrogen and helium, and they used spectroscopy to be able to determine that. By looking at the chromosphere, they were able to tell what the chemical makeup was, and they figured out that, okay, stars are made of hydrogen and helium. So then the assessment was like, okay, well, that's we know now that we know what stars are made of, what if we look at the other stars that are, God knows, unknown amount of light years away? And what they found out was that when they were looking at these the stars, the galaxies, that the galaxies, so basically, okay, in the visible spectrum of light, if something is moving towards you, you're going to see a shift towards the blue, okay? Because it's known as the Doppler effect, and what happens is that your wavelength is getting reduced, and you're going to see a shift towards the blue. So what is going to be, naturally would look yellow or red is going to look more towards the light spectrum towards the blue. And inversely, if something is moving further away from you at, you know, tremendous speeds, you're going to see the shift of the light spectrum towards the red. And this is known as the red shift. Okay? So what happened was, because of this perfect solar eclipse, we were able to look at the galaxies and then be able to determine that every galaxy that we look at was shifting towards the red. The light spectrum was shifting towards the red. What that was telling us is that the galaxies were moving away from us in tremendous speeds. Then when they started extrapolating and working backwards, they realized that the galaxies that were further away were traveling at faster speeds than the ones that were closer. And if you extrapolate this all backwards, it all comes down to the Big Bang. Right? From being able to tell the perfect solar eclipse, we had the evidence we needed to be able to calculate that the galaxies were moving further away from us. And if you extrapolate that backwards, it all comes down to one singularity known as the Big Bang. And in chapter 21, verse 30, it reads, "Do the unbelievers not realize that the heaven and the earth used to be one solid mass that we exploded into existence? And from water we made all living things, would they believe?" And now this is, you know, in the Quran, 1,400 years ago, it's literally talking about the Big Bang. You know, I'm going to read it one more time because this is absolutely awesome. It says, "Do the unbelievers not realize that the heaven and the earth used to be one solid mass that we exploded into existence? And from water we made all living things. Would they believe?" You know, this has been one of the biggest sticking points in atheists or non-believers, is this problem that they see with the Big Bang, the singularity. And now they've come to all kinds of nonsensical workarounds to try to basically bypass this singularity. God willing, we can talk about that another time. But nevertheless, I mean, this is something that's, it's written in the Quran that this is the way it's done. And what else is awesome is that they calculated, so they looked back and they said, okay, from the moment of the Big Bang, there was a time when everything was just gas, and they calculated that 380,000 years after the Big Bang, so 19 times 200,000, that this gas turned to actual stars that created the first stars in the universe. And in 4111, it reads, "Then he turned to the sky when it was still gas and said to it, into the earth, come into existence willingly or unwillingly. They said, we come willingly." So, you know, God is talking about that after the Big Bang, that everything was gas, and God said to it, come into existence willingly or unwillingly. And there's another verse in the Quran where it says, let me just pull it up really quick, that we will bear with me. It says in 51:47, it says, "We constructed the sky with our hands, and we will continue to expand it." So this was another sticking point, you know, at the time of Einstein. They used to believe that the universe was static. And then I believe it was Hubble who discovered that, hey, actually, no, it's not static, it's expanding. And this was something that, you know, for them was a big hit. And in the Quran, it actually explains that, hey, the universe is going to be continued to expand. But, you know, one thing that's just, this is kind of to the next topic, is the perfection of the Big Bang, right? This event had to be the most precise event in the history of the universe, right? Outside of, you know, obviously it's the creation of the universe. But let's look at some of these numbers. There's a ton of videos online, highly recommend going and checking out. It's talking about the fine tuning of the universe. And God actually says in the Quran, it says, let me pull that verse up too. So I'm not finding it at the moment, but basically it says, God says he'll show them the proofs within the horizon within themselves until they realize that this is pretty much the word of God. Let's see. We will show, okay, 41:53 says, "We will show them our proofs in the horizons and within themselves until they realize that this is the truth. Is your Lord not sufficient as a witness of all things? So, you know, this is a proof for us. But let's look at some of the fine-tuning that had to have taken place at the moment of the Big Bang. So at the time of the Big Bang, there's certain, they call them cosmological constants. These are just constants that are embedded inside the universe that have to be absolutely perfect, meaning that the slightest deviation from these set metrics, that the entire formation of the universe, yet alone, you know, planets, stars, life, would not even be remotely possible. So one of the ones is like the strong and weak nuclear force, right? These are the forces that hold the atoms together, that hold the nucleus together, the proton, the neutron, and then the orbit of the electron, the magnetic force, right? The basically the repulsion from electrons, the gravitational force, all these, right? So let's start with gravity. So they calculated that if gravity was one part in 10 to the 60, so that means basically one with 60 zeros behind it. So 60 zeros with a one at the end of it. If it was off by just that smallest fraction of a unit, the universe would cease to exist. So I'm going to repeat that because I kind of butchered it. But basically, if the force of gravity was increased or decreased by one part in 10 to the 60, okay? So that means that you'd get basically 0.00060 zeros and a 1, and you increase it or decrease it by that much, the universe would cease to exist. Either the universe would have expanded too fast, or it would have been too chaotic and too dense and just implode upon itself, right? And this had to have been absolutely perfectly designed in order to even sustain elements, yet alone, you know, again, stars, planets, galaxies, and everything else. The other really fascinating cosmological constant is cosmological constant itself, right? So the cosmological constant is the rate at which the universe expands. It's kind of the opposite force to gravity. And if this was off by one part in 10 to the 123, meaning that, again, you have a zero, basically a 0 point and 123 zeros and a one, and you increase it or decrease it by that amount, the rate of expansion of the universe would have basically either caused the universe to expand too quickly or completely collapse upon itself. And you think of that level of precision just to even formulate a universe, yet alone, you know, planets, stars, galaxies, solar systems, anything of that nature, that it was off by just that slightest bit. And then the last one is just the proportion of, you know, the electrons, dark matter, dark energy, the elements, all this, you know, that were created at the moment of the Big Bang. The precision that was needed, they say, is 10 to the 10 to the 160, if I'm not mistaken. But again, it's just this insanely, insanely large number, if you look at it, small probability. That, you know, just to give you kind of a glimpse, like, there's 10 to the 80, they estimate there's 10 to the 80 basically particles, so the atoms in the observable universe, and these numbers are that much, you know, grander than the number of atoms in the observable universe. And again, I highly recommend, I'm not even doing this justice, watch the videos online. It's absolutely breathtaking. And you know, why am I talking about all this? It's we take for granted the level of precision that God has put into, you know, creating this universe, creating the galaxy, you know, yet alone everything else that comes to it. And we think that, you know, we trust in God. No one's going to be so arrogant to ask God to, hey, God, please change the cosmological constant. Please change the gravitational force or the rotation of the Earth or the spin of the galaxy or anything of that nature, right? I mean, if anyone asks for something like that, it's just absolutely ignorant. But yet, when it comes to our own lives, we always think that we know best. And it reminds me of a verse in chapter 17, verse 11 and 12. It reads, "The human being often prays for something that may hurt him, thinking that he is praying for something good. The human being is impatient." And then it reads, "We render the night and the day two signs. We made the night dark and the day lighted. The that you may seek provisions from your Lord therein. This also establishes for you a timing system and a means of calculation. We thus explain everything in detail. And I think it's just absolutely awesome, the subtlety in this, that God is talking about, you know, human being praying for something, thinking he's praying for something good, when realistically, if God was to give it to him, it's going to hurt them. And then talking about timing systems. And if you look at the universe, the galaxy, the orbits, the spins, these are all timing systems. And God calculated them perfectly. And similarly, in our own life, if we trust in God, we realize that when we pray for something, God answers our prayer, but it's on his timing. And if we have the utmost trust in God, you know, we'll be very appreciative that when the timing is right, that God will basically answer our prayers in the way that's best designed for us. You know, no different in the calculations that God went through to create this universe. He's doing the same amount of care in each of our personal lives. But, you know, for God it's easy, but it's something that we have to truly be appreciative and happy for. And just to kind of recap, you know, we have to be, it's easy in essence to implore God when, you know, things are tough. But we forget that, you know, God created us and put us on the ship, you know, hurling through space, you know, hurling around the sun, the sun's hurling around the galaxy. The galaxy is hurling through space and, you know, all this. And we forget this. We have such stable lives by God's leave where we don't have to worry when we're walking on the street or, you know, sitting in bed or driving in a car, you know, of what's going on outside of our atmosphere. God has just made that easy for us, but it allows us, in essence, to differentiate those who are appreciative, those who reflect on this, and then those who are just unappreciative of God's blessings. So God willing, we're going to stop there. I know it's a lot of information, very kind of tangential, but inshallah, it makes us all a little more appreciative and a little more thankful. God willing, until next time, peace and God bless.